Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale. I'm NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today, I've got one of our most popular guests, Katie Whiffen, who is the founder of theretirementblueprint.com.au. Katie has experience across all elements of finance and wealth management, including asset management, research and financial planning, and she's exceptional at making the really complex areas of finance accessible and easy to understand. Katie, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back, Gemma.
So Katie, one of our favourite conversations as a nation is the cost of housing. In our major cities, we've had double digit growth annually, really, for 5 years or more now. It has resulted in house prices nearly doubling for many people. If you're in Sydney or Melbourne, this is obviously not true of every house in every city, but across the board, Australia has one of the most expensive housing markets in the world. And the proportion of people who own their own home has dropped markedly over the last few decades. So for younger people in particular, it used to be very common to own your own home in your 20s or 30s. It's now very uncommon. It's less than 50% of the population in that age group. So many parents are genuinely worried their kids will actually never own a home of their own, or that they have to die in order for their kids to get it, which is awful. And the only solution they see is to help them buy one with their own money.
Yes, that's right. And when you think of, so the median house price across Australia at the moment is around $680,000. Right. If you want to sensibly get into a home, you should have at least a 20% deposit to do so. So in those circumstances, you're looking at about $120,000 for most people to try and get enough deposit for their home. Saving $120,000 out of your own money, really tough to do, particularly if you're in your 20s, you might be paying off your HECS debt, you've got all those other living expenses. It is really hard to do. So what's available and what's on the table for those people is low. You just got to, most people, it's like suck it up and try and see what I've got. And what's happening during that time frame is the property market is, they feel it's continuing to starting to slip away from them. So the bank of mum and dad, which is not actually registered, that is actually becoming an acceptable, like smashed avocados, it's becoming an acceptable term for finance these days, the bank of mum and dad. And the issue is that unlike a normal bank that is highly regulated, the bank of mum and dad often might be lending things that they are unaware of the consequences of their actions.
It's a really, really tricky one, and I have discussed it with many people, and obviously it's something that people are thinking about a lot. This conversation you and I are going to have is aimed at parents who are considering this issue at the moment, and we'll assume for simplicity that their kids are in their 20s or 30s. They are at an age where buying a home would be fabulous for them in terms of settling them down and getting them secure for their future, but it's not possible. We're not talking about two-year-olds, you know, with negatively geared investment properties and whatever, so as wheeled out by the Prime Minister before the last election. So we're not talking about those people. And that is, it's worth mentioning, there are parents who are thinking about that and buying units and investment properties with the longer-term intention of their kids moving into it. That's an investment decision now that has longer term consequences. We're going to talk now about actually helping your kids move into a home. Chances are your two-year-old's not going to move in and make their own dinner.
No. Or be able to lift the key to the key knob and all those basic fundamentals of getting into your own home. Yeah, so what are the options available for the bank of mum and dad in doing that, first of all? So
first question is, though, should you do it, right? First question, should you? Is this something that you should, as an individual or a couple, be trying to do? Should you ask your kids to stand on their own 2 feet and do it themselves, or should you be trying to help them?
Yes. So maybe is the answer. So realistically, can you as an individual afford to give that money? So let's look at the first case, because there's a number of ways you can skin the cat. Okay. The first one is, if you're going to give your children some money in which to either afford the deposit or to make up for a difference in the deposit or to reduce the amount that they have to take out as a loan. Can you afford it is the very first question. So if you're going to give your children a lump sum, what is that impact for you? Secondly, so that's the very first one. Can I afford? So if you have your own person and you want to give someone $100,000, so you want to give 100 grand away, can you afford it is the very first question. Where is that money going to come from? And when are you getting it back? Or are you going to give it back? So is it a gift?
Yeah.
Will you ever see this? See it again? That's the question. So, and then think of the different ways that you could make that payment. So there is the payment where you just take the cash out of your that's lovely sitting there in your bank account because you can afford it, and you just hand it over to some number one, and that's the end. That's the end of the relationship. Probably is going to be the end of the relationship, at least with all your other children. But if you do that, what they then go and do with that money, what is your expectation around it?
Yeah.
You, once you hand that money over, if there's no legally binding contract, if you have not set expectations clearly and legally, then that's not your money anymore. You have literally gifted it to someone else.
Yes.
And you might be fine with that. You might not want any consequences. You might not want to have any contractual arrangements with that. But if you have other children... What does that mean for them? We always think that we're being fair and reasonable, but people who in the rest of the family, if you have son number two or daughter number three, whatever it might be, they will not feel that that is fair and reasonable if you just gift that money. So you want to be very clear about the amount that you're giving so that you can afford it, number one. Let's presume, take that off the table for a second. Number two, are you ever going to get it back or is it truly a gift?
Yeah.
If you are older, the issue with gifting is certainly around you've got social security implications.
Yeah.
But that's if you are in age pension entitlements, but you also, if you're on any form of social security benefit, you will need to check what that gifting could do for that benefit as well. So just be conscious of that if you're in that category. But it doesn't have to be a gift. You can make it a loan. And this is actually one of the more common ones. So if I, instead of, I still give you the $100,000, but there's a specific term around when you're going to give that back to me. And there's a term around it. It's probably going to be interest rate free because I don't want to make your life miserable. But it might be, well, Gemma, I'm happy to give you $100,000, but in 5 years' time, you will give that $100,000 back to me under these terms and conditions. You get that drawn up by a lawyer. It becomes a full and complete loan with any of the conditions that you want on it. Why do you want conditions? Why do you want to go to the difficulty of going to see a lawyer around it? Clarity. You have absolute clarity about your expectations between both parties. You know, when love and money get in the way, it can always be ugly. But you can also protect you and the person you're giving the money to by having a loan. So let's say that I give it to you and your husband. And I give it as a gift with no expectations because I love it.
Thanks very much.
Because I love you and I want the best for you and you're a fantastic couple. And then 2 years later, you get a divorce. And your husband is probably more than entitled to take half of my gift and go on his merry way with it.
So
there's that issue that once I gift that money to you, there is no there's no recourse whatsoever. If I have a term in my loan that says under these conditions, regardless, the term has to be paid back. If you sell the house, whatever it might be. So that's one way, instead of just an outright gift. Make it contractual, and a loan might be far more superior to cover off all those issues than an outright gift.
So I'm going to give a practical example about this one because I'm a very firm believer that if you do want to help your kids, we'll talk about some other options if you don't have cash, right?
Yes,
many people don't have cash or assets they can give their children to help them, and there are plenty of other options in that scenario. But if you happen to be fortunate enough and well situated enough to be able to support your kids with cash. We'll call it cash, right? A share portfolio and so on's probably not going to help much. You're going to have to literally use cash as a deposit for the home. But doing it as a loan is incredibly beneficial. So the one of the scenarios I've seen is where the parents did make a loan to the children in question. They did one for each of the two children. And each child knew that they were both getting the same amount. The term, however, because the parents didn't want the money back, they were very well off, they didn't need the money, but they wanted to ensure the loan was there to prevent against it being lost in the event of a divorce, if there was, you know, any kind of addiction scenario or the house was called in, someone was sued, all those sorts of scenarios. You know, your child might work in a high-risk industry where they may be at risk of being sued or something like that.
Small business, there's
some kind of bankruptcy, you know, so all of those different variables, and, you know, most people will have one or more of those issues at hand at any point in time. So what they did was they put a loan arrangement in place that was very simple. It said, we are lending you this money. The interest will capitalize at the bank bill swap rate or the, you know, the lender's mortgage rate or whatever it might be. So they chose a particular interest rate that reset every year. the interest will capitalise at that amount, but unless one of the following occurs, we will not call in the loan. So the loan will be there and forgiven on my death. So they were like, we're giving you the money, but we're not giving it to you for legal purposes. And the terms that they put on it, though, were if you get divorced, if you sell the house, if you, you know, in the event of bankruptcy or something like that. So they put a whole list of conditions on. They had a really good solicitor, obviously, who worked through those components. But it was one where the parents were able to give the child all the benefit of the money without needing to pay it back. And if it's $100,000 out of a $600,000 portfolio, they may not be able to pay it back in 5 years,
that's right?
That's right. They've got another $500,000 to pay down. That's probably going to be a bit challenging.
Yeah, and look, like your example, the great thing about having an agreement in place is all those things that that you feel are implicit and that you don't actually talk about because you're talking about family and money. You just have these expectations that you might not actually articulate very well.
Yeah.
Getting it drawn up and legalised really helps you bring those things to the table. So you really, you really understand what you're doing. Mm. You're protecting yourself, but you're protecting the person that you love and you're giving the money to as well. So it's really a smart way of giving people money and giving them the leg up to the property market that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. So to give a horror story, by the way, of someone actually doing the gift, this is a true story from quite some time ago, because as you'll guess with the amount involved. So this is a friend of a friend, a young woman. The parents were obviously very well off. They were in Brisbane. They had a beautiful home of their own. They had more than enough money for retirement and everything else. So they bought the daughter and her husband a house, just bought the house for them as a wedding gift. So it cost $300,000, let's say, at the time. And the daughter was in her 20s, and within 5 years, she and the husband had a $150,000 mortgage on that home.
So they'd taken a lovely debt-free home.
Yes.
And basically lifestyle expenses, rather than putting it on the credit card, they put it on the mortgage.
Yeah, so they were doing some beautiful overseas trips and all of these marvellous things. Now, subsequent to that, she got pregnant and had to take some time out of the workforce, and they couldn't pay off that debt. So then they came back to mum and dad and asked them to pay that off as well.
Nice.
So, So scenarios where you just outright make gifts to your children, it may not be they're getting sued or injury or illness. It may just be that they've perhaps not learned the skills they needed to learn to be able to manage their own finances.
That's right. And because we don't talk about money openly, even within families, we don't talk about money openly enough, it can lead to a lot of miscommunications about what people think gifting actually is. So yeah, giving money, that's one way. But they're the two ways. If you're going to gift it, just, you know, it is a gift, don't ever expect it. You know, just be careful about it. A loan can be actually much simpler in over the longer term.
And safer for all involved.
Absolutely.
Parents and children.
Absolutely.
Perhaps. Okay, so many people obviously can't afford to hand over a lump sum of cash. And this is where people start thinking about, should I borrow to buy an investment property and then they move into it and pay it off over time, or do I let the kids live at home for the next 10 years? The smashed avocado one I find really interesting. We did a very basic analysis of just how many years you'd have to go without smashed avocado in order to be able to afford a very basic home in a capital city. And, you know, let's say you had smashed avocado on toast and a coffee every day for the next, you know, 7 or 8 years.
You're still going to be getting your deposit together.
Interesting analysis.
So when you're buying a home, remember that nearly everyone takes a mortgage out, aside from your lovely friends 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, they have one after a while.
Nearly everyone needs to be lent money in order to purchase a home. And you want to have a really good savings track record before you approach a lender to lend that money. You want to have, and you also want to have that good behaviour embedded before you go and get that loan, because you do want to pay that loan off and eventually own the home outright.
Yes.
So setting up really good disciplines beforehand will absolutely help you. If you're a parent looking to help out your children, the easiest way for them financially is to let them live with you.
Yeah.
Right? So they move back home. Sure, you're 25. You've been out having a great time for 5 years. Come back home. Sorry, for 5 years. Come back home and you'll be basically, you're living now rent free.
Yes.
So for some people, if they are in, you know, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, etc., and there's more likelihood that your family's in that local area, that can absolutely be a non-directly monetary way that you can contribute to for your children's saving. Because saving, you know, $400 a week in rent gets you a lot farther, a lot faster than giving up your, you know, smashed avocado and coffee. So that's absolutely one way in which you can help people, and lots of people do. I think the average age of moving out of home now, and we've got the census I think coming up this year again. So it'll be interesting to see how this has changed, because the number of people who were 30 and living at home at the last census shot up by something like 20% from the previous census.
Wow.
So it is a really, it's not something to be ashamed of anymore. Like again, I'm showing my age, but when I left home, I would never have dreamt of going back to mum and dad. That would have been like I had failed in my lifestyle choices. Whereas nowadays it's completely acceptable, if not in fact expected, that you will stay at home to help save a deposit. Now, for mum and dad, of course, they don't want to then just be the housekeepers for the children. So it can come under a lot of pressure really quickly, because it's a lifestyle choice, not just for your children in their 20s and 30s who might be moving back home for a year or two, but it's a massive lifestyle choice if you've been either alone or a couple, empty nesters for a couple of years, and then having that, basically a shared household back again. But for if you don't have money for a lump sum, that's a great way, and that's why a lot of families do try and help their children.
You were making the point about setting expectations earlier, and I think this is also one where you can set expectations, where you go, if you are living in my home, first of all, you've got your jobs to do. I'm not your mother. From a housekeeper, I'm your mother, not your housekeeper, perhaps, let's put it that way. So, ensure that they take on some responsibility for looking after the home and all those things. But also, I imagine as a parent, you would be fairly miffed if your child moved home and was still going out, spending money on whatever they liked, on rent, but still living quite an extravagant lifestyle if you're trying to help them save. So you probably need to put some expectations
in
place.
That's right. So if your children are coming back to you and saying, look, can I move home to save a bit of money, you can say, sure, this is what my expectations are. What are your expectations? So my expectations are you're moving home to save rent, that you're going to be saving that rent, and that you will not be living here in 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. So
what are your expectations?
Whatever
it might be, and then it's like anything, it's a negotiation.
One that I've seen that I thought was really impressive is where parents charge their children board when they move home. And don't tell the children, but put that in a separate account and give it back to them when they leave. So that is perfect for saving. So they go, you're going to pay board to help cover my costs and so on.
Yes.
And then when they move out, they will pay for the white goods or something and return that money to them. But not avoid the moral hazard by, not letting them know that's occurring.
Setting those expectations up front. But also, if you've got a 24-year-old, man coming back to live with you in your household, there's going to be quite a lot of food that is going to be eaten.
It's very reasonable to charge board actually just to cover your costs.
To cover your costs. But no, you're absolutely right. There's lots of little ways that as a parent you can actually set up the infrastructure for your children's success if they do move back in with you again. Yeah.
One I've been thinking about, and I don't know anyone who runs this business model, but it's worth considering, is if you have a financial planner or a financial advisor that you trust and that you've gotten good advice from who's been able to support you, one thing you could consider is actually saying, I will pay for my kids to get advice, and that person puts the discipline and infrastructure around their future plans.
Absolutely.
I imagine many years ago, parents would have been thrilled to help their kids get set up in that way with the right advice in their sort of early 20s.
Yes.
Thinking about how much better off they'd be in their 30s had they been doing that for 10 years rather than leaving them to their own devices.
Yes, absolutely. And anything where you can help them save, and that might be getting external advice to make through a financial advisor to make that happen, effectively crafting a saving strategy for them by reallocating their board money and helping them save money through not paying rent. Once all that, when you stack all those behaviours together, you can get a fantastic result in a short period of time that doesn't involve you handing over half your retirement savings for them to fund a deposit. And it does give them really good discipline. That's the thing. If they're after a really good discipline, which is what you need when you're repaying large loans that most of us have these days, you're going to need that discipline to work over the long term.
Yeah, which is back to the point also about managing expectations. If they haven't learned to go without something.
What's that word?
Just some kind of deprivation, some privation of assets.
Most people don't know what deprivation is. Saving for a long-term goal, putting off today what you can have today. Why would you do that? It is a framework that certainly people under 20 don't get. You can always learn it.
It's more just going, it's great that you saved really hard for 12 months, but it's not going to get heaps easier when you have a mortgage and a home.
Yeah.
You not only have to consider the cost of the mortgage and paying it off, you've also got to consider the actual cost of running a home, right? You've also got to, all that money that your mum was spending on food.
Yes, that you now
have to pay for the food.
That's right.
And, you know, if the hot water system breaks or something else goes wrong, you know, you need to meet those expenses. And giving kids the skills around those sorts of things and an understanding of how those things work is really powerful. So just teaching your kids about money in a very simplistic sense can be pretty important.
Yeah, and look, we use the word kids here, but people in their 20s and 30s will be quite, you know, depressed.
It's a nasty shock learning some of this stuff if you've been, you know,
living
going on your merry way while somebody else is paying for everything.
Yeah, but also a lot of children don't know what their parents' financial situations are.
Mm.
So they don't know what degree of a burden or relief it is for them to be, you know, at home. They might think that it's fantastic to be at home and helping mum because mum's lonely, and in fact mum is suffering.
Because
not only are you in her space where she was really enjoying her life, but you might be a significant financial burden for her, but she might never talk to you about it. So that's again why setting those expectations early, crucial.
If you have kids, so if you are the child in this scenario and you're considering moving back in with your parents to save money or hoping that they may be able to assist you. If you've got kids, and this happens a lot, right, people, young people who have children who haven't bought their first home yet, one option is the parents actually providing some childcare too.
Absolutely.
Because that can be a significant saving.
Absolutely. $100 a day. You know, you think of the changes also to the new childcare rebates that are going through. That can have a significant impact for a lot of people who want to go back to work and are now marginal about doing that. If your parents can provide free daycare for them, life-changing. Likewise with, you know, pick up and drop off from school when they become school age, all those things can add significant additional expense to your life, and helping children out that way can be phenomenal for, again, for them to save for that deposit.
So you're probably worth pointing that out to people, again, being explicit, saying, you know, this can save you this much money, perhaps you could put that money aside and start thinking about how that is going to help when you want to buy the home.
Yeah, and look, you might think that it's an uncomfortable conversation to have up front, but it is far more comfortable than having that nagging annoyance when you're picking up and dropping those kids off, and also you know that you're then babysitting on Saturday night because your children are going out once again and spending the money that you think that they should be saving. So, yeah, have those conversations early.
So the last one that we'll cover off, because we're getting questions about this, and I know you and I have very similar views on it. So the First Home Saver Super Scheme.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I've got the S's in the correct order because they love changing this one around. Anyway, First Home Saver Super Scheme. Yeah, anyway, that one. Thoughts?
Yes. What a whole lot of sound and fury about nothing would be my thoughts. No, seriously, you know, I think that this was spawned from the idea over New Zealand with the KiwiSaver, because of the way they structured it, they leapfrogged a whole lot of issues that are in our Australian super system. And one of them is that you can withdraw your savings to buy as a deposit for your first home. So they've sort of tried to do the same thing in Australia. What it is that you contribute up to $15,000 a year, additional into superannuation, a total of $30,000 in contributions in total, if you qualify.
Excluding your employer contributions.
Excluding your employer contributions. Yes. So you can get put into $30,000 into superannuation and then withdraw it to pay for a home in the future.
Yes.
Now, so a couple of things with that. So as per our conversation earlier, the median house price is $680,000 across Australia. You know, $30,000 in additional savings inside superannuation is not going to get you a huge way.
Yes.
You have to have the cash flow to the additional cash flow to put into this system anyway. So the first question should be, should I put it into super or should I just save it outside of super? Because this is not a handout. You know, with all the great government, you know, particularly state government grants for first home buyers, this is not a handout of $15,000. This is a, we're giving you another way to save that money. So you must have to, you must have the cash flow first of all.
So I think the most important thing with this one, and it's extraordinary, you need to have a very good understanding of how the tax system works and how the super system works in order to be able to do the analysis and understand whether it's beneficial.
Oh, correct, absolutely, which we all do, which we all do. It's an, it comes naturally to anyone leaving school, really.
That's what we do, it's around, because, you know.
So, yes, so first of all, is super, so you might be able to get a tax deduction on the additional contribution.
Yes.
If you haven't, remember, it's $25,000 each year that everyone's got their limit to.
Yeah, it's a maximum you can contribute on a pre-tax basis each year. Including your employer contributions, right?
Including your employer contributions. Yeah. So if you earn $100,000, then $9,000 will already be part of your SGC, which means you can only actually contribute another $16,000.
Yeah.
How many people earning $100,000 have $16,000 worth of free cash flow anyway? I'd question that. So first of all, you need to make the decision, is superannuation the right vehicle for it? It will depend upon your current tax rate. Superannuation, yes, you can get a tax deduction up front for that money, so it might be good from a salary sacrifice perspective. The difference ongoing is that the earnings are taxed at 15% versus your marginal rate of tax. If you have a marginal rate of tax significantly higher than that, well, then there could be benefit in that for you. It really depends, though, upon the time frame that you're going to have the money in there anyway. For me, with the whole First Homer Super Saver program, it is just massively complicated for not a lot of benefit. I'm usually always one for if you don't leave anything on the table, don't leave anything on the table. But this is one of those little opportunities where it's just like, I think that there are easier ways to save money that you can control, that you can understand, that aren't going to be as impacted by legislation. As I said, I just think it is an overly complicated opportunity that has only just recently been introduced. So we don't even know right now how many people are being able to taking this
up. We've never seen anyone make a withdrawal from it.
And we've never seen a withdrawal from it. And also just be aware for people, you can't, not every superannuation fund can take these type of contributions. So you need to check if this is something that you're interested in, that your super fund can actually do it. And there's some really good steps if you do want to follow it and you think that it's a great opportunity for you. I think it's a limited opportunity. I think there's, you know, like a handful of people really that it's going to that it will benefit. And there's a lot of ifs in something like that. You know, it's a lot of ifs. So, yes, great that directionally that the government's trying to help people with tax advantage savings for the shorter term for a home deposit. But yeah, it's just, I think, a bit of product puffery by the government to say we're really helping with home affordability, and then it's not really helping
at all.
So
the things that we've done a bit of analysis on it, and the things that I pulled out of that were that if you were on the highest marginal tax rate, so you're earning over $180,000 a year, not the average first home buyer, let's be honest, but let's say you are, and you're earning less than $250,000 a year because that's the rate at which the extra contributions tax kicks in. So you don't want to be paying 30 cents in the dollar on money going into super. That's not going to work for you very well. The absolute maximum in tax you can save is maybe $10,000. But then when you withdraw the funds, they're taxed at your marginal rate less a 30% rebate. So you might lose of that anyway. The other things that I don't think anyone's really talking about are your super fund generally will invest your money according to the asset allocation that you have in it.
Yes.
So it might be in a growth fund.
Yes.
If you happen to want to withdraw, first of all, it's quite difficult to get the money out in a timely manner. And if you're buying a house at auction, that's not ideal.
Yes.
But also, if you're trying to withdraw your money and there's just been a market correction, you lost 10% of your capital.
That's right.
That's no good. The alternative is you keep it in cash, but the fees on superannuation are much higher than your average cash account.
That's right, you're only $175 in superannuation.
No, so you may well give away more in fees if you keep it in cash than you've saved, or you give away more in market movements than you've actually saved. You're right. There are so many variables, and very few of them really point to a beneficial outcome for most people.
And so I think it's if you're on those kind of tax rates, so a higher tax rate, if you've got strong cash flow, definitely worth having a look at it. But for most people, I would just say keep in something that you know, in a structure that you know and understand, where you can access it when you want. And depending on how close you are to buying your first home, when you can access it and you know the amount that you're going to have, you know, straight away.
So this is obviously we're talking to parents in this particular situation. So if you are a parent and you are trying to think of ways to help your kids, it would be unusual that the first home super save that one is I've got to get it right. Would be one that we would recommend, frankly. It would be pretty unusual. And as a parent, you can't generally help your kids using that scheme. You can give them money to make a contribution on their own behalf. That would be generally an after-tax contribution, in which case you or they have already paid tax at their marginal rate on it. It's not great.
No, No. So, yeah, it's, as I said, a whole lot of sound and fury about something that's not particularly beneficial. And I think most people wouldn't understand how to get that benefit. Mm. And there's just too many ifs to really show the payoff in that strategy.
So one of the other strategies that we haven't talked about, but it's very popular, at least in public mind, maybe not used so often, is the idea of going guarantor for people.
Yes, and I think that it's popular in the public mind, but once you start investigating it, you back away pretty quickly. Well, the So the idea with a guarantor, it sounds really nice in that, you know, if something goes, so you take out the loan on your house, mm-hmm. and if I go guarantor, I stand behind you, so that if you can't pay back the loan mm-hmm. on that house, then the bank will come to me.
Yes.
So that all sounds very nice because I trust you, you're my daughter, I know that you're more than capable of looking after yourself. Nothing could possibly go wrong. More than happy to back you and be your guarantor. Yes. That's the conversation that people have about it. It's very far from reality. And if you are even thinking about going guarantor, mm-hmm. be incredibly careful. I would suggest that there's not a lot of upside behind it. So first of all, if we unpack it, why does someone want to be a guarantor? Why does someone need a guarantor?
Because they can't afford it in their own right.
So if you're going to be guarantor, you have to think like a bank. We were laughing before about the bank of mum and dad. Mm. Even though you're not lending the money, if you're going guarantor, you have to think like a bank.
Right.
Do you know the financial situation of the person that you're going guarantor for? Mm. You might love them, but do you understand their financial situation?
In detail.
If they are, so for example, let's say that your daughter is unable to work for whatever reason, and so she loses her income. Mm. The mortgage needs to have repayments made on it. Mm. She's no longer making those repayments. After a while, the bank will come knocking. Who is going to be responsible for those repayments? Mm-hmm. You will be.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable that you can take on those repayments for your daughter? Does that fit in with your cash flow? How would you get that money? Mm. If you can't get that money, you don't get the house back. Mm. You have got nothing to do with that house that your daughter has bought.
Right.
The bank has a mortgage over that house, so it goes to them first of all. Mm. You don't get that house. That house has nothing to do with you. What has everything to do with you is the loan backing that house.
Right.
So you need to be incredible. If you're going to go down the route of guarantor, you need excellent legal advice mm-hmm. behind it. You need to really understand the consequences of what you're getting yourself into. Mm-hmm. And you need to really deeply understand the person that you're backing in terms of a guarantor. So most addicts, for example, this is a great one. So they're a guarantor because they haven't saved enough money and they need it, and the bank will lend them money based on their current income situation if they have a guarantor. But say the addicts hide their addictions really well, they have a gambling addiction, and all their money disappears, they lose their job, you have known nothing about this, and then you're landed and saddled with their debts, and they come after you and they come after your house.
Yes.
It is something, it's a horribly shameful experience. So again, people don't talk about things they're ashamed of. So there's not a lot of discussion. You talked before, it's popular in the public mind. Mm. But the downside, I think it just happens to other people. It's actually more common than you think. Guarantors going bust. So if your child can't get a loan, you need to know why.
Yes.
Banks are, you know, generally they're more than happy to lend money. That's how they make money, is lending money. They're more than happy to make money. If this person doesn't have the strength to back it, why not? And why are you comfortable backing them when some of the strongest institutions in the world are not?
Right.
So yeah, you need to think really, really carefully about that. And again, separate how much you love them with how much you can afford and what the impact could be on you. Most people think guarantor, nothing will ever get called upon. Mm. If it does, you need to be prepared.
They wouldn't ask for it if there wasn't a risk.
And a big risk.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, a significant one. So finally, one thing that I think people also struggle with, and it comes back to the point you've made a few times, that people are not great at talking about money, even with their loved ones, and perhaps particularly with their loved ones, and that is that if you have multiple children, so, you know, average family now is 2 kids, but, you know, we're talking about people in their 50s and 60s, they might have 3 kids, 4 kids, 5 kids, your situation may be different, and their situations are all going to be different. They will be different ages, pretty obviously, unless you had quintuplets. You know, but one may be married, one may be divorced, one may be single parent.
Yes.
One may be single.
Yes.
One might be still studying, one might be in the gig economy, one might have a really high-paying professional job. So you could have kids with really, really different scenarios, and therefore really different needs. I'll give my own personal situation because I think it's interesting. My brother has a disability, he has an intellectual disability. My parents' responsibilities to him are dramatically different to their responsibilities to my sister and me. So my sister and I have taken the view that they gave us a good education and they certainly owe us no more than that. If they wanted to do something, that's entirely their decision. But realistically, anything that is available needs to go to support my brother because he can't provide for himself. Not every family is going to have quite such an extreme example, but how do you accommodate that?
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. So say you go guarantor on a loan for one child, you are going to be probably unable to then lend money from your house, all those other things that could restrict you because you're guarantor for one person. Mm. Or if you've gifted money to one person or made a loan to one person, what does that mean for the other people? Most family examples, when they give money or lend money to someone, they don't tell the other children.
Yeah, that seems dangerous.
which creates a whole lot of problems, and they don't talk about it in their, because they don't talk about their wills and their estate planning with their children, so they don't talk about how other children could benefit in the future if they wanted to, but it creates a lot of tension. So if you do want to help out one of your children over another one of your children, just think through what's equal in your mind, why are you doing this? Just articulate it just to yourself, first of all, just like why you're willing to give one child $150,000 and nothing to another child. And that then might make it easier to then actually go and have those conversations. But again, with equalize, if you do want to be equal, there's lots of ways that you can fix the issue of equalisation at a later date. It could be through estate planning. It could be through the terms of the loan arrangements that you might make with your children. Likewise, if they're moving back into home with you, you possibly can't have three children and their spouses and all their three kids living in the one establishment. So again, you just need to think through what you think is fair and reasonable and why, and articulate it to those other family members so Christmases aren't really uncomfortable.
It gets really tricky and we can't possibly go through every different scenario, but it's very challenging for people to manage large families, and you have to consider the fact that some kids, particularly if you are divorced from their other parent, for example, you know, is dad helping and you want to help, or is dad only helping one kid or another? So if you can, in that scenario, have a conversation with your former spouse, that might be something you need to
do
as well.
And because it's not a family tree anymore, it's a family jungle. And so when it comes to any form of monetary compensation, it gets really ugly really quickly. So number one, know your own situation incredibly well. Back to our very first thing that we were talking about, know your own situation really well and what you can afford. Figure out what you would like to do, what do people need, and then work through and do have that conversation with them. So there's people who's widowers who remarry, who might remarry with no money or a lot of money, and they end up supporting someone else's family that's got nothing to do with their original intentions. As I said, it's a jungle out there. So have a really good clear map of what you want and what you can do with the funds that you've got. Because you can really help people. You can really help your children. You can help them spectacularly, but you just have to know the pros and cons of each of the approaches.
Katie, thank you so much. Now, retirementblueprint.com.au.
Retirementblueprint.com.au.
People can find you there.
Find me there.
That's all we've got time for today. I hope you found it useful. As always, thank you so much for joining us. If you have any questions or feedback, please feel free to email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Cool. Are we done?
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.